Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for joining us for this discussion tonight about a collection of wonderful novellas, some of which have been published in Griffith's Review and another which is a standalone. My name is Julianne Schultz and I'm the editor of Griffith's Review, and it's my great pleasure to be here again at the Wheeler Centre, which is always a wonderful, wonderful place to have a great conversation. This event this evening is a joint activity with the Wheeler Centre and Griffith's Review, and I should acknowledge in that that collaboration the Copyright Agency Limited, because the Copyright Agency has basically sponsored the two novella projects now that Griffith's Review has run. This is our second collection of novellas. The first was published in 2012. One of the reasons it's lovely to do things at the Wheeler Centre is that it's such, you know, it's a place where the history and traditions of writing and thinking are so physically present, and I think that's always a great thing to be reminded of for those of us who are in this this writing and ideas business. As I was mentioning, this is the second novella collection that that we've published at Griffith's Review. The first was a project that we decided, I think it must have been about 2010, we thought that that it was probably a time when the changes of literature and politics and publishing meant that the changes of literature, politics, publishing and so on were creating an opening for fiction which was longer than short stories but shorter than a novel. And I can't quite remember when that particular brainwave occurred to me, but I was sort of quite pleased to see that at the time that it did, we were slightly ahead of the curve of what was happening internationally. And around, so in this sort of period, as people have been adjusting to electronic devices for reading and thinking differently about the appropriate length of stories that can be published in as short fiction, that we embarked on this novella project with, as I said before, the support of the Copyright Agency. And around the same time, a whole lot of other organisations and publishers also started to experiment with this form, which was sort of interesting because it had been lost. While there are, of course, some wonderful novellas that are really defining defining moments in the literature, whether it's Death in Venice or Of Mice and Men or Clockwork Orange, I mean, there's a whole list of really spectacular novellas that sort of fallen out of favour, and partly it was about the sort of economics of publishing. You know, why would you buy a skinny little book for the same amount of money as you could buy a fat book? You know, it was a hard sell in a bookshop. In an electronic environment, that becomes very much a different sort of proposition, and it allows the sort of experimentation with form, which I think had been lost sight of while publishing was being shaped by what could be sold in the bookshops. This process of the revival, I mean, has been really terrific, and I think it's liberated a lot of writers to be doing things which they maybe not have thought about doing before. So at that point, I'd just like to introduce my guests here this evening. On my immediate left is Jane Jarvis-Reed, who's a writer from Melbourne, and her debut novella, Midnight Blue and Endlessly Tall, won the inaugural Viva la Novella competition and was published by Seizure in 2013. Please welcome Jane. In the middle, I have Megan McGrath. Megan's a fiction writer from Queensland. Her work's been published in a number of anthologies and journals, including Griffith's Review, Meangen, Seizure, Tincture Journal, and was one book of many Brisbane's a couple of years ago as well, which is a wonderful program that's run by the libraries in Brisbane. She works for the Brisbane Writers Festival and tutors at the Queensland Writers Centre. Her story in the Griffith's Review novella collection, Whale Station, is her most recent work. Please welcome Megan. And Our other guest this evening is Kate Kennedy, who's obviously very well known, I'm sure, to all of you. She's a very highly acclaimed and much loved Melbourne writer. Her novel, The World Beneath, won a number of prizes, including the People's Choice Award at the New South Wales Premier's Awards in 2010. She's written novels, she's published short stories in both anthologies and in journals and in international magazines, and she's also published a collection of poetry. Kate's novella in this collection is the one that we're going to kick off with today. So please welcome Kate. Now, the challenge that we had for this novella collection in Griffith was Griffith Review was that I really wanted to do something which was about telling historical stories. It seemed to me that in Australia we'd forgotten about our history. I mean, we had a few iconic stories, we had a few bits and pieces that we kept on telling over and over again, but the richness and the complexity of the sort of little bits of history was being lost. And so when we went to Cal with that proposition a couple of years ago, we said, look, you know, there are big international books, there are local books which have made a real impression in terms of this trying to tell history through fiction, but I want to see whether there are littler stories or different sorts of stories which would really suit the sort of novella format, and let's see what we come up with. So in that particular case, what we did was we put out a call for writers and we asked people to come up with propositions, and then we commissioned five people to write, and two of them are here tonight. It was slightly a different exercise because I think in lots of cases, and indeed with the novella competition that we're about to launch again, we'll ask people to send in fully completed works. This time we went to it around the other way. And Kate, you're thinking in terms of the place of history and the telling of stories and how you work that back into the creation of a novella, I think it really goes to the heart of one of those, that the problem of that question. Mm. Can I read back to you a quote that you gave us when we were talking about it, and then sure. Ask you to reflect on it, if I can, in small writing? You said, "What fascinates me about writing about recovering forgotten stories is how often they are the real tipping points for much bigger cultural defining moments and events." That often come after them, all the more potent because they are invisible. It's a seemingly small piece which in retrospect jars us into discomfort and sometimes a reluctant reassessment. Mm. That's what you've done with this story, isn't it?
Yes, I literally tried to do that. I thought to myself, that is what interests me, I guess, the idea of this, the small thing, the little thing that is not noticed so much. Mm. And I think it's our job as writers, as well as people interested in history generally, is to pay attention, to pay attention to small things that are usually overlooked, because often they seem to be the key to me that, as I say in that little quote, that sort of opens up this other vast thing that's happening behind it. And then we think to ourselves, of course, I just didn't notice it, I've just sort of stumbled across it.
Mm.
And often those little things do seem to be in our path in that way, but we are persistently not noticing them.
Mm.
And when I started with the story, I thought it would be great to write a story where someone literally finds themselves reluctantly excavating something, someone digging something out.
Mm.
And it's something, about, as you said earlier, that problem with history is that we go down that cul-de-sac of simplification where there's just no going back. We end up with these few worn-out, cliched, simplistic kind of iconic stories, and that's meant to be all there is for us. That's meant to be the ones that we can have in our grab bag of ideas about ourselves, I guess. But to me it just seems there's endless sort of multiple narratives going on there, seething under the surface, that are waiting to break through.
And so
I love that idea of I'm going to have someone actually digging to see what happens,
And a character who's come in with a very sort of fixed and rigid preconception of what the place might be. I mean, because it's the juxtaposition of those things in your story in a way, isn't it?
That's right. It's people with an expectation they're going to find something, and they're so determined to find it that they begin to kind of make up their own history, I guess, and create it for themselves. They're renovating an old hotel and they really want it to be this kind of groovy bed and breakfast in this country town, and they'll do anything to kind of find some history that's going to make it appealing to the people who come and stay there, to sort of, you know, have Burke and Will stayed here, or, you know, Robert O'Hara Burke slept in this bed kind of stuff. So the locals begin to bring things in. The locals want to have the bar open, and they help them out because they want to have that pub opened again. And so they've put all this memorabilia everywhere. Mm. It's like an installation. It's like a theatrical sort of set of props. But, of course, things have their own stories and things have their own sort of provenances. And I guess that's what I wanted to sort of find. The person telling us the story is the person who they employ to dig out their cellar. And it's not everything that they hope that they're going to find there. So.
Spoiler alert.
And that's right, I'm not going to tell you more.
So we'll come back to that a little bit more as we go on. So Megan, if Kate was sort of animated by the sort of these multiple layers of history and so on, I mean, it seems to me that your piece is very much animated by a place, and a place which is sort of recent but strangely distant.
Yeah. So my novella is called Whale Station, and it's set in 1962 when the Tangalooma whaling station closed down on Moreton Island. And it's what happens to a few of the employees when they literally get there and there's just no more work for them. And so the reasoning behind writing that story is because I grew up on North Stradbroke Island, and so my family has quite a strong connection with that place. And I realised that now that I live in Brisbane, there's a lot of people that, for one, haven't even been to North Stradbroke Island or Moreton Island, and further, that a lot of people aren't familiar with the history that it has there, and it's just recent. It's the 60s. It's not even really that long ago. And when the theme came up for the Forgotten Stories, I was like, well, this is a story that's been forgotten, and if I don't tell it, probably no one's going to tell it. Mm. So there's only one other book about the Whalers of Tangalooma, which is put out by the Maritime Museum, and it's about the ships. So, and that's it, really. That's it. So
do you just tell us a little bit more about that whole whaling story in Southeast Queensland, or it's actually an Australia-wide story, isn't it? So
yeah,
because so I think it is forgotten. These
yeah, days. Yeah. So there was a couple of stations. There was one at Byron Bay, and there was one at Tangalooma, and they literally shut down because they ran out of whales. So, and that's the story that I'm trying to tell. I'm not pro-whaling or anti-whaling. I'm just saying that we did this here and we did this here not very long ago.
Mm. Yes, somebody said to me after reading it, it was sort of Moby Dick meets the Greens.
Yeah.
And so Jane, your novella is very much driven, it's very much located in a place, it's sort of inner northern Melbourne, but it's very much driven by character, so it's sort of different in its sort of genesis, I suspect, to the other two. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, it was definitely the characters that started speaking to me before I had any notion of what the story was going to be about. The novella is set here, kind of in two main places, in a sort of run-down, old, probably California bungalow style in Brunswick, and in a new renovated North Carlton terrace house. I was working with two main characters, Eloise, who is a middle-aged woman who's had a recent divorce, and she's now working as a mental health carer, and her new patient Eloise, who is probably in her early 30s and has experienced some sort of a breakdown. And these two lives, these two kind of lone women, are sort of brought together into this carer-patient relationship. I think working in the form of the novella allowed me to really put a magnifying glass on those two characters. There's just a single story arc, which is pretty common for a novella, and it just kind of allowed me to really flesh out those few key elements and sort of turn those characters inward on themselves and turn the relationship inward on itself until kind of, I suppose, implodes for better or for worse. Mm-hmm.
Before we talk a bit more about the sort of processes of writing, the challenges of writing these novellas, I'm interested from each of you about how these stories found you. I mean, it's always an interesting thing for creative people. You know, what made you write this story? Why did you feel you had to write this story rather than something else? Do you want to keep talking about that?
Sure. Well, I suppose I subscribe a little bit to that Jungian idea that all of your characters in your dream or in your story yourself. So in a very uncomfortable kind of way, I suppose, I'm writing myself when I'm writing these characters. I didn't know the story that I was going to write when I started. Mm-hmm. I had a period of 6 months which I'd carved out just for writing. beautiful little time. Mm-hmm. And I was working on a few different projects, and I started this novella, Midnight Blue, as an experiment. So every day I would work a little bit on it, and I worked with three rules. So I had to write a little bit every day, didn't really matter how much. I wasn't allowed to reread anything until it was finished, and I wasn't allowed to limit the story in any way. So when the characters wanted to say something or do something that I wasn't cool with, I had to let them do it anyway.
So they weren't writing to a plan that had been mapped out in advance?
No, I didn't really know what was going to happen. I started to get an idea of where the story was going pretty soon. Mm. The story kind of wrote itself in that way. Mm-hmm. So after a few months of doing that, I didn't realise I was writing the last scene, but I wrote the last sentence and suddenly thought, oh, it's finished and I've got a novella. And then I sort of forgot about it for about 6 months.
Right. Okay. That's great. Megan, you said before that, you know, you felt that you, an obligation in a sense that you knew these stories and so there was something that you could bring to it. But why about whalers? I mean, you could have written about sand miners or, you know, any number of different things.
Yeah. I think the theme for the forgotten stories was quite important. I probably wouldn't have written this piece for anything else, so I'm so pleased it got in. but with this one, it started because I was having a conversation with my family almost a year ago, and I was talking about the whaling on Moreton Island, and my sister, who's only about a year older than me, she had no idea. And so I thought that was really surprising that we both had grown up in the same place, but we had two different narratives of our hometown. So that to me was, and I was like, well, who else doesn't know about this story now? And so I started, one of the beauties of being from the area is I started just asking people and met with a few people that did actually work over there. And so my main character, Rick, is very loosely based on some anecdotes of a gentleman, Mr. Lidsley Nash, who still lives over there. So I had the pleasure of going over and talking with him and interviewing him and his wife. Mm-hmm. And to get some of those other, there's sort of forgotten stories within those forgotten stories. He's in his 80s now, so he's, forgetting a few things himself. So to be able to get down some of his stories as well was really sort of special to me. So there's a few bits in there that go, there's stories within the stories and a few like urban legends, I suppose, particularly with Whale Rock and Whalebone Reef. There's a few other little stories in there that I get to tell, which, thanks to the novella, gives me space to do that as well. So, yeah, it was definitely a story for that collection. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Great. Kate, how did you...
I really like primary sources. I like the kind of hidden life of objects. Mm-hmm. So when you find something that you find really intriguing, it makes you follow that trail. And one thing I saw was it was an artefact from a museum, and it's a flag, one of the oldest ones we have in Australia. And it was the Southern Cross flag, which was the one that was flown the Eureka Stockade. But it was exactly like that flag, but it had written on it, Chinese out. And it was from the Lambing Flats riots that were 7 years after Eureka Stockade. And I began to do a bit more research on that flag. And looking at... See, at school I always felt very proud of that Eureka Stockade history. We love that idea, don't we? It's like the big iconic thing, the underdogs against the police and the mining inspectors and, yeah, go. But then we sort of look at the history of that Southern Cross flag, and it's been flown and all sorts of things maybe we don't feel quite so proud of. It's been claimed, it's been part of the White Australia policy, it's often now used as a tattoo for extreme right-wing groups. So the more you kind of uncover, the more you sort of find that stuff of the hidden life behind the thing. So, yes, I just began to do a bit more reading and found out more about... I was a bit shocked to find the history of the Buckland riots, which were some other riots very near where I live, in northeast Victoria, which I had never heard of again. And yet... there they were, all around us. And there is a small plaque now in that area. But I certainly hadn't heard that history of Chinese miners being forced out by a huge writing mob of people. So it was just one of those things where I was shocked and surprised at that hidden history, and I thought I could find, it's like you were saying, you find a way to put a story within a story to frame it in a certain way, and a novella is a fantastic framing device because you can develop those ideas, characters can be invented that feel plausible, that discover and uncover those ideas and feel just as uncomfortable as you do. It's got a nice way to kind of bring that story to its kind of resolution.
Yeah. I mean, it is an interesting challenge, and I don't think it's confined to Australia, but I think that the nature of Australian settlement history means that and the extent of sort of migration patterns over the last 60, 70 years has meant that we've become reluctant to tell, or we just fail to tell stories because somebody's always coming new, who's got something new to it. It's a new blank slate, you know, and here we can start all over again.
Yes.
So finding that sort of the layers that are there, you know, is actually, I think, a revelation to people as they embark on it through, as you've described.
You begin to wonder whether those things are willfully forgotten, you know. There were certainly many, many more writing white miners at Lambing Flats riots and there were at the Eureka Stockade. But we don't hear about that story so much.
Yeah, I think it's, particularly with my story as well, it's easy. People want to forget. People want to say, be looking out and making judgments all of the time, and it's really easy just to put down that curtain and pretend that we didn't, that we're squeaky clean, that we didn't do anything.
It's and all, look over here at this heroic thing over here instead. You know?
Yeah, no, it really is, yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. Is that something that you engage with in your writing and thinking, Jane, as well? Any of that sort of those layers of history and so on? Not necessarily in this piece of writing, but just more generally.
Yeah, definitely. I sort of feel like we're at an interesting point in Australia and at the moment where we can kind of start to speak with a bit more honesty about our stories and the stories that aren't ours, but maybe stories that have been silenced in the past. I think people are starting to open their ears a little more and be willing to hear those other voices.
So the challenge of the novella, I mean, Kate, you said before that you thought it was a great device for this you know, extending the range but not going too far. I mean, what are the challenges, what are the opportunities, and how does it differ from the other forms of writing?
I'm such a short story fanatic, I guess, and short stories are really hard because of that brevity. But it's, I think I've been led to them because I think limitation actually is a fantastic thing in fiction. I love limitation in writing generally because you're swimming in this, you're floundering in this world of language. There aren't any material limitations there. You know, if you're a painter, you've got limitations. You're working in two dimensions. If you're a sculptor, you've got limitations according to, you know. But with writing, what is there? You just got this incredible world of language. You're just going to spin something out of nothing. So to me, it's like you're spinning a sort of a plate on a stick, and it's like this sort of, the beauty of it is the you know, creating that sort of centrifugal force that can make it happen. And a novel, I must admit, does seem to me that it's so hard. There's like 15 plates on sticks. And you're the clown who's, you know, putting out more and more and more and running back and trying to keep them all spinning. And the short story is beautiful because it's just about one thing. But the novella, it's, I feel, in my own limited way, I can kind of handle that kind of length. And it's not too difficult because one thing that can happen that's wonderful is characters can bounce off each other in terms of antagonism. And that will push that plot further. They push that story forward. It's not something that's the universe coming from somewhere and making something happen and then we see somebody forced to change or something, which is, you know, the kind of classic arc. In a novella, you can add these complications and you have that luxurious space to just watch then what characters do with that new challenge. And you watch what they do when things are uncovered and how they scramble to explain or to reassess or to react in a way which is giving them a whole lot of new challenges in terms of now. How do you explain what you're doing now? How do you look at your behaviour now?
You know? Did you know your characters would find what they found when you started writing the story, or did they find it as you found it, you know, during the process?
I think I knew. Look, let's just do the spoiler. It's kind
only
of
if you promise to buy. Only like, if you yes. promise to buy it and read it.
No, they want to make this kind of heroic, historic goldfield bed and breakfast. And what they find is a box that they think is going to have special historic things in it. What's inside it are these pigtails that they have cut off as like a souvenir. It's like someone's, you know, it's like scalping. And that's what has been kept in this box as a kind of a souvenir. And that really did happen. It really did happen. And I think what I remember seeing a engraving when I was researching the Buckland riots of someone grabbing a Chinese person or a celestial, as they were called. You might have seen this picture yourself, grabbing them by their pigtail. That was how they would sort of grab them and then beat them up. And so one thing you would do would be to cut off that pigtail because it was culturally very insulting for them. Mm. It was very negating, dehumanising for them. And people would keep those as souvenirs, often making them into a switch for a horse whip. Ugh. Anyway, it just makes me feel... It's not like a skull or it's not like a... But it's something where that's a kind of a gruesome souvenir. Mm. So I think when I saw that picture of someone holding this... There wasn't any photos. Mm. Someone had to... Some artist's impression of what those riots were like is the thing that I remember seeing in the paper at the time. Mm. And everything... I quote lots of things from the paper. Mm. I did find that newspaper and that's exactly what was in the paper. Mm. I haven't made up anything. I've just found it myself and put it in there.
It's very confronting. I mean, and it's beautifully written, so you know, knowing that won't spoil the story.
Sorry, I hope it doesn't spoil the story.
It won't. Yeah. It'll add to it. Megan, in terms of your writing, I mean, in terms of the sort of challenges of writing to this sort of novella form, I mean, how did you find that differently? I mean, what was the sort of... How did you adjust?
I prefer to write short stories too, Kate. Mm. And so I came at this as a way to... If you could put in all of the things that are normally just in the subtext of a short story, that's how I sort of chose to write it. So it is still just moving to one point and the... A lot of extra character development that you can do, and the way that they change.
It feels quite luxurious, doesn't it? You've got space to kick around that you don't usually have.
And you didn't have to put any false stuff, which you do with novel writing, that there's sort of, you know, go up to this point and then shut that door down and so your characters need to recess. They're still moving, so it's got that momentum of a short story, which I really enjoy, but then, luxury of the extra words was beautiful. Mm. And mine changed a lot with the research, the story that I was going to write, which is the same story, but some of the actions that they were going to take, being confronted with this, that the Wild Station was closed. Some of the things that they were going to try to do as I was researching, I realised that it was just completely impossible and ridiculous. Like at one point I wanted them to go and build this boat and they were going to go and be whalers on their own, which is absurd, completely absurd. And the boats that they have to use are huge. Mm. And it's not, in my head, I had pictured it as a bit of similar to a prawn trawler or something like that. And when I went to the Maritime Museum...
You saw one of those Moby Dick paintings. Somewhere.
Yeah. And you just have your knife just taped to the end of your broom handle and you can just go out there and get it done. And so when I was doing my research at the Maritime Museum and... the gentleman who had written the other book, The Whalers of Tangalooma, his name is David Jones, like the store. I was lucky enough to meet with him and he gave me a lot of his research and a lot of his photos as well and talked about the ships. And so through that, I realised I needed to change what was actually going to happen. So there's, without any spoilers, there is the scene in there where they go and they look at this boat, which is one of the first scenes that I wrote. And Christian, who's the Norwegian whaler, is trying to convince Rick that it's going to be fine. We can just do up this thing and the boat is so bad it doesn't even have a motor in it. And Rick's like, come on, mate. It's just not going to happen. Mm. And so that was... And being able to keep that in, that was, I guess, that was a bit of a false start and a bit of a plot point.
But that becomes a reassessment then, doesn't it? So you can use everything.
Mm. Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Megan, was his name really Davy Jones?
David Jones, sorry. But Davy Jones would be amazing also. Yeah.
There's one called Ishmael as well. Yeah.
One of the things I really liked, the character, the descriptive stuff in piece in your work, Megan, about the chasers, you know, and the sort of movement, you know, the people who were doing the whale chasing, and, you know, go, will they make it to Albany, to where the whaling business kept going longer than it did in southeast Queensland. I thought that was... There was something really powerful about that. Maybe in a sort of FIFO context, you know, that people are following this work.
Yeah, they're working. Yeah. So the Norwegian crew, so the Australian at Tangalooma, the Australians weren't in charge of actually capturing the whales. That was all Norwegians that came out. And so it would take them 72 days to sail out here from Norway, and then they would work for the season, which was May through to October, and then they'd sail home. And so it's not really... a lot of time back in Norway before they turn around and come out again. Mm. So there were some that would stay out here and not sail home. And so that's two of the characters that I've got. They've relocated out here. Mm. And the story about how Rick becomes a whale chaser, so someone that gets to work on the boats, is true. That he was just going to work on one of the other boats, which is the towboat that takes the whales from after they're captured and takes them back so that they can be processed. And one of the Norwegians got rip-roaring drunk and didn't make it, and the character of Rick goes down and gets on this boat that he thinks is the towboat, but it ends up being one of the chasers. And that's legitimately how Mr. Nash ended up being a chaser, because he got on the wrong boat because someone was too drunk. So, and so capturing that was yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting. There's a terrific photographic installation at the Beach Hotel in Byron, which was the whaling station as well. You know, of that, you know, that beach, which is now, you know, the last place you would in any way associate culturally or in terms of lifestyle with whaling, of the big whales, blood. You know, the whole the jetty that went out forever. I mean. Mm. You know, as you were saying before, I mean, this is quite recent, but it's so profoundly different.
I got access to some photos as well that are actually owned by the Courier Mail, so I'm not allowed to share them. But there's one with these guys, and they're just muscly and tanned and just wearing no shoes, no shirt, completely unsafe, and they're standing with these flensing knives on top of the whales while they're processing them. And just to see that image, and then there's little kids there watching. Like, they used to go over and watch. You could take your family over for the day to Tangalooma.
A bit of blood sport.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And these kids with their little caps on. And it's just really, it's so recent.
Mm. And now they go on the boats to look at the whales as they go past. Mm. Yeah. So this is the first novella that you've written, Jane.
It is,
and
yes.
Your previous writing is primarily short stories, short fiction.
Right. Yeah.
So how did you talked very beautifully about the process of creating it, but I mean, when you reflect back on it now, I mean, how do you think differently? Do you want to do another novella, or are you not so interested in that form?
Well, I'm working on a novel at the moment, and I have worked on a novel in the past, which I kind of wrestled for a few years. Well, several, more than a few probably, but it never quite sort of came together. But to me, a novella, it's just a beautiful amount of space. Mm. I was wanting to talk about intimacy and love and sex and boundaries, and to me this is just the perfect space because I know I'm going to have you, all things going well, for a few hours on the couch, and you're just going to, hopefully you're not going to get up and you're just going to read it through. And to have someone with you for those few hours... just feels like a cozy, beautiful little place.
So what's your next project, Kate?
I'm struggling. I hate to hear you struggling with a novel, Jane, because I feel the same. I'm struggling with a novel, but it's a kind of a novel in stories. Mm-hmm. So I've set myself this task to put it together. Speaking of plates on sticks, my God. So it's kind of a series of self-contained chapters that make their own short stories. Mm. So there's kind of multiple viewpoints, and it's kind of grounded in... I guess I have to say climate change. Mm. It's the sort of the pressures that fall upon communities and individuals and society, really, when stuff we're not in control of happens to us as a result of stuff that nobody wants to look at, to do with the way we're living. So it's looking at those sorts of pressures. And, of course, it's very hard to finish because that is happening. You know, every time I look at it, I see it sort of forming like this huge hydra and changing. I can't seem to pin it down. That's right. So I'm just going to keep on persevering until, it's like you were saying, do you feel like you've kind of got to the end and it's right size, it's right shape?
Yes. And so in terms of doing that, I mean, are you approaching it as an integrated whole, or are you approaching it as a series of things?
No, it's an integrated whole, which makes it even kind of weirder, because you really want the narrative to, you know, you have to do everything for a reason, that's the thing. Mm. Otherwise, why not just write a novel? Why would I do that? So you sit there for ages thinking why you're doing it that way and berating yourself about why you're doing it. But you want it somehow to be that the kind of the meta story, without sounding too pretentious, that the bigger narrative is stronger because it's made up of these multiple viewpoints, and that you're actually getting a view of a whole town in a way which is, there isn't any right answer. There isn't any one way of forging your way through to come up with a better solution. There's just different people trying to form a community, which is to do, in terms of what I think, with interdependency. And so that's, people need each other. Otherwise, it's not really a community. If you don't need each other, then you're just basically a whole of houses living side by side. We really chuck that word around very easily, don't we, community?
Yeah, we do.
So I can see, you sort of get a bit of a perspective on your own vision, and then you kind of sort of see how it might fit together a bit better. But meanwhile, you're just piecing a whole lot of stuff together. You're not really sure how it's going to come together until you just keep writing through it. So listening to you talking about that researching, Megan, is very interesting to me, because as you're doing it, you're discovering what you're on about, I guess, in a way. You just know you're drawn to it, and you it's going to keep your attention, so you have to hope it's going to keep someone else's attention as well.
I think a story kind of finds its form as well. If you're, as the writer, if you're listening to the story and you're open to it becoming what it needs to become, I think that a story has a kind of true fit, or the right form for it to grow into. And the way you're working, Kate, at the moment with the many stories that are going to form a larger story, it doesn't sound like it could be any other form than the form that it's becoming.
Yeah. And that's the thing that's kind of a bit annoying, is you go down that track and you feel it kind of curing into shape, and then it's not so fluid anymore because you're committing to something. But the same, I love that idea. Wouldn't it be great to think that you have an idea and you think, what am I going to make out of this? And you're so open to what it might be that it might be a poem or a short story or a novel or, I don't know, a libretto, I don't know, anything, all the stuff you haven't even tried, a performance or something. Or I love that thought that we can actually honour the material, even if we don't know what we're doing really, really well. We just want to make sure that we're doing the best job we can to give someone the jolt that something has given us in the most honest way we can, which is how fiction works in a way which is really true to me.
It's interesting because what we do with, what I do with Griffith's Review, you know, is we choose a theme or a topic or whatever, and then commission widely, I mean, in a way, to get those different points of view. And some of them will be because people have got different ways of thinking about the same subject. Some of them will be different styles of writing and so on. And the most exciting part of it in many ways for us, and I say this now having done it for however many years, 11 years, is that process of compilation at the end. So we've got all the pieces together. The next edition is about Western Australia. We're doing it at the moment, and the trying to get the voices to work so that they complement each other, add to each other, so that, you know, the dedicated reader who wants to start at the beginning and go to the end will actually get a different sort of experience of the layering of those voices than you would get in from any one of them. And so it's a curatorial task in a way. It's quite different to what you're doing, but there is a similar sort of element.
The intent is the same. It's like how to do this justice, you know, how to do this in the best way to do it justice, and to let that story sort of I had a workshop last week, and I was describing to these students like that had to sort of put a metaphor into a story. It's like you're like a butler. That's what it feels like. You're a butler, and you make something, and you just want to just put it there on the table, and then just go discreetly back away. You know, you don't want.
And people stumble across it and say, "Oh, I didn't know."
Yes, I guess in a way it is like that. Yeah. Oh, thank you. Oh, canapes. You know, like, you don't know who to thank because the story's right there. Yeah, it's sort of you want to do those stories that you're uncovering that you're fascinated by. And the way you compile them, you're making an emotional journey for a reader in the same kind of way that a writer is by saying, let's place this against this. Mm. The structure, you're doing it as a kind of an intentional gift in a way, you know. Yeah. So it's you want to do it justice in that way. Yeah.
Jane, one of the things that I think very strongly is that your story illustrates, or your novella illustrates very beautifully, is the importance of voice and point of view. I mean, your two key characters have very distinctive, you know, there's a very distinctive sort of voice that attaches to them. I mean, I'm just interested in your sort of thinking about how you manage that, you know, in a craft sense almost.
Mm. To me, that's the most fun part of it. Pretending to step inside someone else's perspective for the space of a short story or a novella. I think as a writer I like to challenge myself as well, and I'll have an inkling of the voice that is starting to come, and then I think, okay, who can I be here? Or who can I be that's the furthest away from who I am? And even whilst I'm writing them and they're, I don't know, a 50-year-old man who's a sexist bigot, then maybe I'm writing him, but I'm thinking, there must be something. I'm writing him and I'm feeling what this character, I think, is feeling. There must be something that connects us. So I think what excites me about that use of voice and use of varied voices as a writer is that you get to exercise your empathy. Mm. And you're encouraging the reader to exercise their empathy as well, and saying, you're a million miles in person or geography from this person, but see how he's you too. Mm-hmm. But I think it's selfish because it's fun for me.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think it's probably time for questions. So we've got a couple of microphones. There's a man in the middle. There are three men in. One, two, three. Yeah.
Hi. I was just wondering what everyone's opinion is on the label novella and how, whether you think that limits, from an audience's perspective, the want to read it or even pick it up in the first place, when really they could just be called novels. As in, like, could it be better to just leave it at that, or is it like treading a dangerous ground to call
them? I think as short story writers, we're already terrified because we were constantly told that nobody wants to read short stories, and yet short stories sell really well and people enjoy reading them. And I think with the novella as well, and part of the revival, is that we're grooming readers to want to read something of that length. And like you were saying, like the intimacy that you get of being able to sit down with something that you can just read in one sitting. It's an afternoon. You don't have to carry it around in your handbag for 7 weeks, like Shantaram or something. I think that's beautiful. And I noticed as a short story writer that short stories in Australia sort of hung out around that, you know, 3,000 word length. And then they started getting shorter. They're getting shorter and shorter, flash fiction and microfiction, 99 words. And then nobody wanted to read that anymore. And I think with long reads and novellas, people are looking for that now.
You're right when you say it's just a label. But if we're all sitting in North America and we've just written three 18,000-word stories, we'd be calling ourselves short story authors. It is just a name. It's just a thing about length. It's just a way to kind of categorise a story in terms of its kind of clarity and intent and how it's put together, and it is different from a 400-page novel to read something, as you said, that you can read easily in one sitting. But, you know, never say never. We'd love to say, that's my definition of a short story. It can be read in one sitting. It's like, how long
do you sit?
Are you a fast reader?
How long are we sitting? Yeah.
How long are we sitting? That's right. So I do think it is just a label, and it's a little slim thing, and it doesn't mean that it's not intense and rich. I mean, some of the greatest writing, I think, in English is novella, is short, is slim novels, beautiful little gem-like novels, which I keep returning to again and again because I just admire them so much. I don't know how they've done them. It's just a wonderful thing to see. So, I don't know, it's just a name, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it is just a name, but the length does enforce, you know, I mean, it's not like there is one format or one style, you know, there's a whole lot of different things, but the discipline of a certain amount of brevity does force a whole lot of other decisions.
Yes.
And I think that's where the strength of it, in a way, comes from.
Distillation,
you know,
of ideas.
It's a distillation, but it's not so spare that, you know, that you're left. And, you can have quite... I mean, there are novellas which are quite interiorly focused works. But, in many of them, there's not the richness of the interior life that they may be in a much longer work. Uh-huh. It's. I mean, I think it's interesting. I think it's partly about it's about the writing that's right for a time, in a sense. You know, everyone's feeling so pressured in terms of the amount of stuff that's available, the amount of time they've got to read it. You know, I say it slightly in jest, but, you know, that notion of going in and spending $30 on a Ian McEwan book, which is that fat, or spending $30 on a book that's that fat, you know, that in the sort of publishing world, I mean, I think that was something that, you know, people were conscious of for a time. I mean, and it's dissipated is interesting. So these things go around. I mean, I think that the novella, you know, when you first see it in sort of 14th century Italy, you know, in the Decameron, you know, there is the stories that are a series of novellas, you know. So it's sort of, it's an honourable tradition which is very long, you know, in many languages.
Mm-hmm.
There's a question at the back. Yeah.
Thanks, ladies, for your time tonight. Firstly, Kate, in regard to what you just mentioned about North America, do you think that's because there's a bigger market for literary journals and that kind of stuff over there? Like Dennis Johnson writes novellas all the time and they're then published in single format.
Yeah, and there's Kindle singles, which are novellas as well. You know, there's all kinds of ways that people are finding to publish that stuff. But certainly when I first began to write short stories, it was Australia sort of said, oh, no, in Australia we would say 3,000 or maximum 5,000 words is a short story, but anything above that is... It seemed to be that we only define things in terms of length, not in terms of kind of quality or depth or clarity. And, yeah, I think there are many more opportunities for those longer short stories in the US because certainly that's where people make their name doing that. It's the other thing about brevity and distillation is it actually is fantastic for showing what you can do. It really shows who can do it. Who can do that paring down, who can compress, who can write dialogue that does what, 10 chapters of exposition would do and that kind of stuff. So I would say, North American writers, the ones that I meet, find it really odd that we write 3,000-word short stories and we joke that they just don't know when to shut up and that kind of stuff.
That's true.
But, 12,000, 14,000 words is nothing. Having said that, I've had a couple of things published this year in US magazines and they love the shorter the better at the moment. It means they can get more things into that magazine. So I guess in hard copy at least it's becoming an issue.
Look, I think the other thing in the US which is sort of relevant is that sort of the cycle of creative output which may end up in film. You know, so if you look at the sort of the transfer from novella to film, it's actually a much easier sort of transfer than a novel to a film.
That's true.
A novel has just got so many extra layers. It's, at its essence, if it's going to be reduced to a film, something has to give. And in a way, I think in that what is very commercial sort of market, that people are thinking about novellas or, these things which are somewhere between 10 and 25,000 words, because they may have a life that is easily translatable into another format.
That's true. I'm sure, Annie Proulx would say Brokeback Mountain is a story.
Mm.
It doesn't matter what the length of the story is. It's just some are long and some are short in that collection, and Brokeback Mountain was the one that was optioned to be made into a beautiful film because those elements are really clearly and beautifully expressed.
Mm.
And it's the same, lots of Stephen King's novellas are made into really effective films and they seem to work better. Even The Shawshank Redemption, one of the longest films, was actually a much shorter novella.
Yeah.
And it was the adaptation let it kind of become
to
richer and more visual and more cinematic. So never say never.
I have one more question, if I may be so bold and hog the microphone. question, ladies, on novellas and linear timelines and narrative. Do you think novellas are better suited to straight up chronologies, or can you mix them up? Or apologies for not reading your novellas yet.
I'm thinking about the lover, Marguerite Duras, the lover, and that mixes up the time. We're hearing her speak in the present tense as an old woman about when she was a young woman. And I think it works beautifully. I don't think the novella necessarily demands a linear time sequence. What do you guys think?
You know, I feel I've only just barely got my hands on the wheel, and I go for a linear chronology just because that's how I can see it laid out in front of me, and I love it. I love convention. I'm a really conventional writer. I feel that convention, the form is just so capacious. There's so much room to do so much, just starting at the beginning and going on and getting to the end. It just seems fine to me. I've got plenty to be going on with in that, but at the same time, if there was a reason for making discontinuous narrative or chopping it up or having someone looking back and then showing, you know, stories within stories seem to be what is emerging to me.
I think as long as you know where it actually fits, if you did iron it all out, then you can break it up and do anything that you want with it, as long as you know where it's going. Mm. And the important, what I feel the novella does well is it's just moving to one point. And so that does lend itself to a linear structure, and I could talk about narrative structure all night, which I won't. But yeah, there are other devices that you can use to be more creative with your storytelling, and like Kate, yours switches tense at the end, which I thought was really beautiful, and because that jumped forward and changed that pace, and that was lovely, and really simple, really easy to do. So.
When I think, there is some playing around in the five stories that we've got in this collection. I mean, there's John Kinsella plays around with time and place in his piece, which is set in Western Australia around the sort of Camellia sort of story. But he moves between in time in that piece. Masako Fukuyu is more linear in her piece, and in a way the most linear of the pieces that we've got in this is Emma Hardman's, which is about a story about the 1919 influenza epidemic, and it works through, you know, in a quite sort of chronological sort of way, but about a very particular time. So in this I think maybe that the historical framing probably invited that sort of approach this time, because I think that in the first novella project that we did, there were a couple of pieces which did use quite a lot of discontinuous narrative and were quite sort of, you know, doing
subheadings and all sorts of things and chapter breaks and
and changes of voice and character in time and location, you know, so it was quite, there were a couple of pieces which were quite ambitious in the way that they did that, and they worked, you know.
And maybe that's when you're looking at stuff which is historical, that you're uncovering something that's story-like. You don't need to muck around with that, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Life is always going to show us something in terms of story which is so beautifully self-evident that maybe that's just, once again, to try and just do it justice. You don't need so little revision sometimes, those stories. Yeah. It's right there. You know?
It's interesting because when I first made the application to Cal for money for it. I mean, I was very conscious of, you know, the big historical novels, obviously, you know, the Kate Grenville stuff or the, you know, the Hilary Mantels and so on. But I was also very influenced. There were a number of books that came, this is a few years ago, there were a number of books that came around which really played around with what you can know and how different sort of perspective, you know, sort of a quite postmodern sort of take on historical writing. And so I was sort of, you know, in the framing of it, I was really hoping that we were going to get pieces that people were playing around with the form and what do you really know, you know, how do you layer this, you know, depending on the sort of perspectives and so on. And I was sort of secretly hoping that we were going to get some of those in this trawl. It didn't happen, so that's all right. There are plenty of times for
nothing
it to...
Nothing experimental to us.
But it's good. I mean, but it's sort of... It is interesting because... you know, I think that the form, you know, the just having that constrained word length opens up possibilities, but it maybe closes down some others as well. So there's a question back there.
I wonder, you were saying before, Jane, about a story finding its own form, and I wonder, I mean, Midnight Blue and Endlessly Tall had such a beautiful momentum to it that you chose to end it at the moment of implosion, as you say, about the relationship. And, but for me, having finished it, I felt like in my head the story kept going, and I wonder how it is you made such an elegant decision to stop it when you did, and whether perhaps it's a novel is that, but with another act added onto it.
Thank you. I don't know. I don't know. as a reader, I always appreciate when the writer leaves something that I have put together in my mind unsaid, and I suppose I'm seeking to do that as well.
But isn't that a wonderful tribute that your character, he wants to know what's happened to your character, so you've fully animated them in his mind.
He'll keep writing the rest.
That's good. Yeah. That's great. Yeah. That's what we all aspire to.
Yeah.
Are there any other questions here?
Thank you. I'm a very amateur, long-term short story writer. Felt before I get buried, I better write a novel. So I've got my characters, I've got the end, and as I work it, I find, look, this is really only a short story, but I don't want to write a short story, I want it longer. Yeah. And so I start stringing it out, and I suspect now it's a novella. It's two characters only, don't go into them very deeply, climax. And I can appreciate from your point of view that a novella length doesn't depend on, I've got to get to 30,000 words.
Sure.
It depends on what you had to tell.
That's right.
And how long it took to tell it. But if I went to where I'm used to going to 3,000 to 5,000 words, if I went to 25, and I think, that's enough, I've got a novella. Have I still got a novella if I was at 50, 60?
That reminds me of Raymond Chandler. Someone said to him once, what happens you run out of ideas? He says, I never do. I just have someone come in the room carrying a gun. Make things worse, complicate things. It's like, that's that plotting thing, isn't it, I guess? But it's going to be as long as it needs to be, isn't it? The story, it's like Jane was saying so eloquently before, the story finds its own kind of length and depth and breadth, I guess. And it's you have to somehow try and do that justice, I think, you know.
And I think maybe the words, it's not about the number, it's about the story. So if you can write just a cracking short story with your two characters and going to where they're going, wouldn't you prefer to do that, to have this perfect short story, than to have 25,000 words but you might not need 20,000 of them?
I think when you start getting bored of what you're writing, you know you're about 20,000 words over.
and because I operate in a world which is somewhat constrained by terms and conditions, we've just announced the novella competition for next year's Griffith Review collection, and we've said that the word length is somewhere between 10 and 30,000 words. So that's a pretty big range, but hopefully that may be a place for your thing.
Go to it.
So, there's one more question here, and then I think that'll probably need to wrap up.
Do any of you have some favourite novellas?
Yes, I am very fond of Animal Farm and of Mice and Men, I would say. I would return to them a lot. And there's other novellas I love for their decisions, like because you feel flummoxed and then full of admiration for why Nick Carraway is the narrator of The Great Gatsby, for example. That's a decision. That's a choice that the author's made. It's not accidental. So craft-wise, there's lots of novellas that I love and return to because I want to, read them again to not so much work out how to do it, but why we do it. Why do it? Why make those choices and try and sort out how you can be as audacious, I guess.
I'm going to sound really cliched here and say The Old Man and the Sea. And it's choices as well. So to have two characters that don't have names, I think that's...
Yeah.
And you can still feel so strongly for them. And I quite enjoy, which might be shorter than a novella. Is it a long short story? I don't know. Jonathan Livingston Seagull. yeah, which is really important to me when I was growing up.
And it's a very sort of yeah. straddy sort
yeah,
of...
Yeah, isn't it? Yeah.
Fable. Yeah. Novella fable.
Yeah, which is... I'm not... I bought it again and read it recently and I didn't... It's changed. They've done something, but that's not... It hasn't ruined it. But those small volumes and... yeah, there's so many. Steinbeck is phenomenal. Mm. Yeah, he does some good work.
What about you, Jay?
Well, I loved Helen Garner's The Children's Bark, but the one that really sticks with me is a really strange, quite darkly humorous novella by the Israeli writer Edgar Caret.
Oh, yeah.
It came out in a collection of his short stories called The Bus Driver Who Wanted to Be God, and the story is called Nella's Happy Campers. And it's set in an afterlife, which is only for people who have ended their own lives. But he somehow manages to kind of negotiate this territory in a really quite funny, kind of still grim, but humorous and enlightening sort of way. And he's dealing with this very alien world, but he's still making the reader kind of laugh and nod their head and say, oh, yeah, I know what you mean. I loved that one.
Mm. Great. Well, thank you all so much for sharing this with us this evening. It's been a great conversation. Thank you.
Thank you, Julia.